Just by way of introduction, my name is David Russ. I'm an application engineer for Siemens. So my role is to work with customers and prospective customers to figure out how best to apply our technology to solve your engineering problems. So part of that is involves things like this, where we're doing basically training about what the technology can do. I also train users how to use it, and then I work with users on solving problems and things of that nature. I tend to focus quite a bit in what we call the process industries. Part of that includes pharmaceutical applications. Prior to joining Siemens, I have a PhD from the University of Louisville in chemical engineering, where I studied CFD modeling of mixing tanks. CFD and processes and pharmaceuticals are all kind of at the heart of things that I do on a regular basis. Quick show of hands, who in the room has prior CFD experience? A couple of y'all. Who may not have experience, but at least has familiarity with CFD? Okay, about half of y'all. All right. So over the course of this afternoon and tomorrow morning, what we will be doing is having a very brief crash course introduction to CFD. The material for this class has been largely pulled from a three-day and a two-day training classes that we at Siemens provide on a regular basis for customers. One is essentially what is CFD, and the other one is how do we actually use StarCCM Plus, which is our CFD multiphysics simulation software. We will be covering some general CFD concepts, as well as looking at some specific applications in the LIO space. And then later this afternoon, and then again tomorrow morning, we're going to have a hands-on workshop so that you can get a feel for what it's like to use a CFD tool like StarCCM Plus. As we're going through this material, almost everything I'm talking about could be applied to any CFD tool. This isn't a Siemens sales pitch. Obviously, the applications that we're working on, we will be using StarCCM Plus to work with, and so that's the technology you'll get to play around with. This intro section is broken up into a few different categories. We'll see some section breaks, and for the sake of the filming, what I'm going to suggest is that we do questions on each section at the conclusion of the section, and then we dive into the next one. That way we have nice clean blocks of data that can then be packaged into videos and distributed elsewhere. Sound good with everyone? Okay. So, introduction to CFD. Why do we do CFD? The main concept behind doing CFD is to create what we call a virtual twin. Or a digital twin, rather, of a product, of equipment, of a process, really anything in the real world that you want to have deeper understanding of. And so some use cases that we see a lot from that are things like reduction of time and cost associated with prototyping processes or prototyping equipment, things of that nature, and then also being able to understand what's occurring there on a physical level. Anyone here do physical testing on your equipment back at your lab, or a few of y'all for sure? I'm sure everyone, at least in grad school, had to experience that. The beauty of doing CFD is that rather than being able to stick a probe in and knowing what's occurring in a single point, we can know what's occurring everywhere in 3D space. So I may have a temperature probe here, a temperature probe here, a pressure probe down here, and then maybe there's a flow rate at measurement at the outlet. That's four data points of what's going on in your system. And we can make assumptions from that sort of thing in an experimental world to extrapolate what's going on in the entire process, but a lot of times we can't. Or a lot of times those assumptions aren't very good. And the value of doing CFD is that rather than having a single data point, we can have hundreds of thousands or millions of data points to really understand what's occurring. So doing this, comparing, I guess, the experimental versus the virtual, in both cases, you're building a jam. You got a question?
Yeah. So you're saying that you could take like hundreds of data points in your model, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what if you're like trying to test something that has not been discovered yet? How would you find the data for that model?
That's a good question. I think it'll begin to make a bit more sense when I start to explain how CFD calculations work. But on a broad level, we're looking primarily at fluid dynamics. So we know things at inlets and outlets, and we know how fluids behave in between. And then the simulation software will do the calculations to fill in the data in between. But yeah, so in both cases, in physical testing and in digital testing, you're building a model of your process or your equipment, and then you are doing analysis on it. You're running a test. The example here is a wind tunnel test, but whether this is a wind tunnel or a lyophilizer or whatever it is, you have to put something in there to actually test what's occurring and then measure data on the outside and try and figure out if this is behaving the way we want it to. With digitally, we can go through this process much faster and much cheaper in most cases than what we can with physical testing. So that's kind of the main driving factor for why we do CFD. These next few slides are coming from Dr. Alina's research, and I'm going to be talking to them from the perspective of things that we're gleaning from CFD. But I'm sure she can talk to you in a lot more detail about the levels of insights that she's been able to see using simulation for lyophilization. But going back to that idea of digital testing versus physical testing, these lyophilization processes, as you know, are not short processes. This isn't something where you turn it on and then 10 minutes later you have some results. It's, you know, these are several days in excess of a week to actually to run the process, right? So if we can cut out that time, cut out the cost of manufacturing equipment and installing equipment and testing it in place, and cut out the energy associated with running the equipment, then we may be in better shape. So the lyophilizer that we're looking at, the image on the right there corresponds to the geometry that we're going to be working with in our workshops. There are a number of physics that are occurring in here. We've got heat transfer of various different modes. We've got the evaporation or sublimation rather that's occurring, the phase change. And then you've got the physics associated with the condenser downstream. Any one of these can be a focus for doing a simulation. When we're doing a simulation, we can focus the simulation on whatever it is that we need to understand more insight to. And so, whether or not we look at a portion of this process or the entire thing at once, both of those can be handled from a simulation perspective. And my understanding is that understanding and properly defining this design space is important for properly characterizing these processes to make sure that you're getting the process rates that you need. If you were to do testing at all these points on here and define this, then you get the information you need to be able to define the design space. But if we can do CFD cases in just minutes or maybe a couple hours, depending on how complex the geometry is, and define this design space much more quickly, then we're saving enormous amounts of time. So in this particular model, this is a relatively simple geometry. We've got nitrogen inlets on the top. We have a few rows of shelves. In this model, the way they have defined this is assuming a mass inlet across the shelf surface to be where the mass is coming off of the freeze drying product. And then we're going to be looking at how the air and the product of the phase change are flowing through the system, the temperature and pressure distributions therein as it flows out through that pipe towards the condenser. And from this, what we are giving into the system is we're telling the software, this is my geometry. So we'll feed it a model that looks like this. And then we'll be feeding boundary conditions. So in this case, we tell the walls, we have what we call a non-slip condition. So there we have a boundary layer that develops across the wall as the air flows across it, for instance. We tell it what sorts of inputs we have at our inlets. We tell what sort of conditions we have at our outlet. In this case, we'll be defining a downstream condenser pressure. And from there, it's going to do a calculation across every computational cell in our system so that while we may know here and here, it's going to calculate from here to here and here to here and so on and so forth until we have three-dimensional data for our entire process. And in this paper, they did experimental validation of their CFD model. And so you guys can scan over these test conditions a bit if you're interested. I'm going to be focusing more on what was done with the CFD. So again, if you want to know more about what Alina and her group have done, she would be the best person to talk to about that. And in this model, they actually did comparisons between StarCCM Plus, which is the Siemens software, as well as our major competitor, Ansys Fluent. And we'll get to see some data side by side and kind of see how those tools compare as well. But you can see the basic setup of the models in terms of the structure of how we approach it is very similar. We're both assuming laminar flow. We're both assuming ideal gas. Similar numerical strategies in terms of the numerical scheme, the simple scheme, etc. The first thing that they approached, and we'll talk a bit more about this whole grid concept a little bit later on. But anytime we're doing CFD and we want to get useful data out of it, the most important thing we need is a computational mesh or grid that is going to accurately capture what's occurring in our system. And so from that, we need to make sure that our grid can capture the geometry features as well as the physical features, the physics that are occurring in our system. So geometry features could be that we have enough cells to wrap around that shelf and understand what the shape of it is. Fairly straightforward stuff. Physical features means including enough cells to adequately resolve gradients in our system. So if we have airflow that is zero velocity at the wall because that's how fluids generally behave, versus a free stream velocity, do we have enough cells in between those two to capture what that profile looks like so that we can accurately understand what's going on here? So, and along with that, there are ways of testing to whether or not your grid is sufficient to produce an accurate result. And one of the ways we do that is what we call a grid convergence study. Here we are testing the same geometry, the same physics on different grids and trying to figure out what's the coarsest grid that we can use without it impacting our data on a significant basis. Finer grids can give us more details, but they also cost more computationally. It takes more time to run a finer grid because it has to do calculations in every cell in your grid. Target here is to try and figure out where that midpoint is, where if I get fewer cells, it's impacting my results. If I get more cells, it's impacting my computational time, but I'm right at the spot where it's not doing either. And you can see that measuring the amount of change in the chamber pressure from one design to another, they were able to see in StarCCM Plus a model that was about 275,000 cells was grid independent. Whereas in Fluent, we got about 480,000 cells. So neither one of those is a terribly large model, but we were able to use fewer cells in StarCCM Plus, and I'll explain a little bit more later why that is. In terms of simulation parameters, beyond the number of cells, you can see that the setup between StarCCM Plus and Fluent were very similar. We'll talk about what some of these numbers mean a little bit later on. Using the same hardware, computational time with Star, we got about 2.1 hours and about 6 hours with Fluent. So again, these aren't excessively long models. If you set up a model in the morning, you can have results in the afternoon. If you set up a model in the afternoon and want to go home, you'll have results waiting for you in the morning. And with StarCCM Plus, you may be able to set something up in the morning and see it by lunchtime.
Quick question.
Yep.
Why are you doing a comparison between StarCCM and Fluent?
I didn't do this, but it's a good idea when, especially from a research perspective, if you're exploring a new application, to just see which code is going to be best for a particular application. We see this in a lot of different industries when people are doing these applications for the first time. In many cases, you should be able to get equivalent results in both tools, but just because the tools are written in a different way, they're not always going to be the same in terms of performance, like computational time, for instance. One might run faster than another.
So you are not Fluent. That's a different manufacturer.
Right.
So,
okay. Right. That's produced by a company called Ansys. They're our major competitor. They were measuring across a range of shelf temperatures. They were looking at the minimum controllable pressure in their system. comparing especially a low Reynolds number case and a high Reynolds number case, those are the ones we're going to be focusing in on. I know this chart has a lot of data on it, but important thing to look at is the percent deviation from experiments for both softwares. Both an experiment and a simulation are going to have some degree of margin of error associated with them. Neither one is necessarily going to be a perfect representation of what's occurring in the system, but it's always best if we have close correspondence between the two, because that gives us greater confidence in both, right? And we can see that across the range here with StarCCM Plus, they were getting data from anywhere from plus 6% down to minus 3% comparing with experiment. Seeing this graphically, the experiments are in green, the StarCCM Plus simulations are in blue, and pretty much every data point on there falls within the experimental margin of error. Maximum deviation we saw with StarCCM Plus was at 6.4%, like we saw on the previous slide. Now, in terms of results, these are some examples of some of the more common sorts of data analysis objects that people will get from CFT simulations. There are lots of ways we can interrogate the data and draw out presentations of that, but some of the more common ones are contour plots. Here we're looking at a scalar value, in this case pressure, and we're looking at a cross-section through the system. So we can begin to see not only what the pressure is at a given point, but how it's distributed. And we can see between the two softwares, we got pretty comparable results. But within the chamber itself, we don't see most of our pressure fluctuations. Most of that is on the outlet pipe, which I believe is how we would want to see it. This is for the low Reynolds number case. Another way we could look at this are vector plots and streamlines. So in this case, we're looking at a contour of the velocity magnitude. And overlaid on top of that, we have three streamlines, actually in three dimensions, if you can see here. A streamline is essentially a measure of what direction is your vector field flowing. So most commonly, people will look at streamlines of velocity. And from this, if we were looking at just a cross-section, we may see recirculation loops of a certain pattern, but we may not understand what's going on with them in the third dimension that's not seen in our cross-section. So that's something that a streamline can help us do. And here we can see visually not just how it's flowing in our cross-section, but how it's coming in and out of the page, and understand where that data is going. One of the additional analyses they did in this was studying the impact of the shelf gap between their different shelves. Remember we were getting simulation results in about 2 hours. If we were to take our baseline model that took us 2 hours to set up and run, and then make changes to this in a parametric fashion, you could easily run through a range of parameters like the shelf height or the temperatures and pressures or whatever parameters you have control over in an automatic fashion, so that you can get data across not just the one design condition, but lots of design conditions fairly quickly. But in this case, when we looked at the shelf gap, we can see that there is a significant increase in the chamber pressure with smaller shelf gaps. So this is information that you could then use for determining how best to design and operate these equipment. Looking at the differences between these two models, the minimum chamber pressure, these are between the two different size equipment here. You can see the volumes 0.74, or that's a area, 0.74 square meters and 0.43 square meters. You can see that we do get a pretty significant change in the minimum chamber pressure, as well as the velocity profiles and the pressure profiles in the system. Now, stepping back specifically from LIO, industrial applications of CFD are far and wide. We're in a lot of different industries. I mentioned, you can see on the screen here that we've got some examples. We've got chemical processing in the right. There's aircraft on the top. And then actually that's a building services application trying to figure out how to put out fires best on the bottom left. Really, there's the tool that we're looking at today is very much a general purpose tool. So it's not just for LIO applications, but other things that you may have in your company, other processes, whether it be mixing tanks, whether it be spray nozzles, whether it be filters, anything that is of engineering concern may potentially be a good application for simulation. So as you go and you have success using simulation for LIO applications, you can also then think, how can I get additional value from doing simulation and doing CFD at other problems that I'm facing or problems that my coworkers are facing? The workflow in CFD, and this is going to be true of most any code, is we begin with an initial geometry. So this is either something that we build or geometry perhaps that you get from a manufacturer, but it's essentially a geometric description of what your system actually looks like. From there, we need to define what our physical model is. We need to tell the system, you know, is there gas flowing through this? Is there liquid? Is it multi-phase? Things of that nature. Define the physics that are going to be occurring in the system. From there, we can begin to define boundary conditions. What's an inlet? What's a wall? What's maybe a symmetry plane? So that we can properly bound the equations that are being calculated. From there, we're going to need to build a computational mesh, and that's where we are taking a complex three-dimensional domain and breaking it up into much smaller discrete units that we can do analytical calculations on. If you try and solve the Navier-Stokes equation in a freeze dryer, you'll find that it's very difficult to do analytically, and I would be very impressed if you're able to do it. But if we can make assumptions that this small portion of this freeze dryer we have homogeneity within, we have relatively the same pressure, same temperature, same velocity, etc., we can solve the Navier-Stokes equations analytically, or not numerically, in each cell in our domain, and by linking all the cells together, we can then get a three-dimensional understanding of what's occurring in the complex system. That's what's occurring in the calculation step. Once we've built our physics, built our boundary conditions, and built our mesh, then our solver can actually do this calculation for us. And it's going to be solving a set of conservation equations in every cell across our domain, and it's going to do it iteratively until it drives towards what we call a converged result. From there, we can then begin to do data analysis on it. First, we check, did this converge well? Is this a good model or is it a bad model? Sometimes, if we don't set up the model correctly, maybe we don't use enough mesh cells, it won't converge, and the results you get aren't very useful. But if it's a good model and it converged well, then you can begin to start seeing how that corresponds to what you should know or want to know from your system. You can be looking at things like the minimum chamber pressure, for instance, or what your temperature distribution looks like in your system. And from there, that oftentimes sparks questions of what if things were different. Maybe I'm changing this process parameter. Maybe I'm doing a higher loading rate or a lower outlet pressure. Or maybe I'm designing this equipment for the first time and I want to change some geometry parameters. That feeds back into initial geometry and we can go through this loop again. And usually the second time through the loop we save some significant time so that you don't need to spend as much time the next time. The workflow in a CFD process, we're going to be looking at starting from CAD here. This is a very simple model where we just have a rectangular channel with an obstruction in it. But our geometry is kind of defined for what's the length, width, height of the channel. We have a wall thickness, and then there's also a solid here that's obstructing our view, or our flow rather. What we're interested in this, though, is the flow dynamics. It's possible to look at the solid as well, but generally we're wanting to know what's happening in the fluid inside of this geometry. Whether it's a temperature field, whether it's the velocity, the pressure, we don't necessarily need that sort of information on the solid itself. We're controlled by what's occurring inside the solids. So from there, we then begin to try and identify what the fluid geometry in our system is. As humans, we can easily look at a duct like this and say, that's my fluid geometry. This is where my air is flowing through. Computers, unfortunately, aren't that smart yet. And so there's some degree of where we need to actually define what the wetted geometry in our system is. Here we're going to be basically filling up that pipe and subtracting out that obstruction, and we're going to be ignoring things like wall thickness. Wall thickness is not playing a role in our fluids calculation, and so we don't need that data. What we need to know, not so much is how thick this is, but how thick this is. From there, we can then begin to extract our fluid part, and then with that, there are Boolean operations that can be done. If these two parts are lining up, take where this part intersect and remove it from this part. And that's what we call an subtract operation, and that's what we end up doing with the obstruction that we see down there, right here. So this becomes our fluid geometry. This is the wetted geometry. This is the geometry that the air or the water flowing through this system is actually seeing. So the edges of this are going to be the walls. You have the obstruction right here. But because in this case, we're just looking at the temperature profile in the fluids, we don't need the solids, we omit them, and this is the geometry that we then proceed with from our simulation. Once we have geometry, we define boundary conditions. So in this case, we have an inlet condition that we define down here. We have an outlet condition that we define down here. And then assume this is a heated or cooled obstruction. We'll specify flow and thermal properties associated with that obstruction to bound our problem. Those are the inputs that we're giving it. What are geometry and what are our boundary conditions? From there, during the meshing process, we're going to build what we call a surface mesh that is, as you may be able to see on there, it might be hard in the back, but a series of triangles that define the shape of our surface. In this case, because we have these nice sharp edges, we'll be able to get grid cells that line up along here and send them across so that we have our geometry defined. We have big cells on these larger surfaces and we have small cells on the smaller surfaces because we need an adequate number of cells to resolve the geometry. From there, we can then build a volume mesh. And the volume mesh is where the CFD calculation is actually occurring. So we're not actually looking at the volume mesh in here. We're looking at kind of the edges of the volume mesh. But we can see that there's some prismatic-looking cells along the edges here. Those represent prism layers. There are prism layers that run along this wall all the length of it on all four sides. Those prism layers are designed in such a way to help you properly resolve boundary layer flows that are going to be occurring near wall, for instance. You don't have your maximum velocity right at the wall. You have it a ways away from the wall, and prism layers are designed to help capture that gradient. And from there, we run the simulation, and we can begin to do some data analysis. So in this case, we can see that the inlet air is coming in at 298 kelvins, but the obstruction is 50 kelvins higher than that. And we can see initially the flow is pretty well lined up, but once we start to reach the obstruction, we can see how it's redirecting, what's that doing to the temperature profile locally, and we can also see the wake from this. There's a recirculation loop that's forming in the wake. We can see how far that's extending and where the flow begins to meet back together with the wall downstream. So you're able to see, in this case, the velocity, direction, and magnitude, as well as the temperature. This is just a sample of the sort of thing that we can get out of this. But for a very simple test case, there's simple questions that we can ask from it. So the key things that need to be involved in any simulation workflow is, what's your geometry? Make sure that you have geometry that represents the volume that you want to do simulation on. In most cases, that's going to be your wetted fluid geometry. So in your case, it's usually going to be the airspace inside of your freeze dryer. From there, we also need to know boundary conditions. For instance, what is what's the pressure as it goes towards your condenser? What's your condenser pressure? There's questions that we're going to go over a little bit deeper about meshing strategy, but we build the mesh, we apply the physics models, we run the simulation, and then we do data analysis. So what's going on behind the software? I mentioned that we're doing a discrete numerical calculation of what's occurring here. And this is a graph of kind of what we're trying to capture here. So in reality, there's going to be a smooth curve. And if we were to try and solve this analytically for arbitrarily simple systems, we could know what this smooth curve is. But for complex systems where we have complex geometry and complex physics, we usually can't solve this analytically, so we measure it in a discrete fashion. And what we need to do is make sure that we have enough points along the curve to accurately represent the shape of the curve. If we don't have enough points, we may not understand the curvature, by having enough points, we can properly capture the curvature and accurately interpolate between the points as to what's going on. So that's called discretization. All of the equations that are involved in the simulation will be discretized in this fashion. So whether it's things like velocity and temperature and pressure, or maybe it's more complex things like phase volume fractions if you're modeling a multi-phase system, or maybe it's shear stresses if you're measuring a system that is shear sensitive. Whatever it is physically, all of those are going to be discretized in this fashion. One calculation is done at each cell for each one of those. In StarCCM Plus, what we're going to see are four main windows that we're going to be interacting with, but we'll be giving inputs to the model on the left-hand side, and we're getting outputs on the right-hand side. So there's graphical outputs as well as text outputs, and then we have numbers that we actually plug in there, as well as kind of an overarching view of how the simulation is structured. This particular image is unique to StarCCM Plus, but most CFD codes are like this, in that inputs and outputs are segregated in such a way that you go here, you go there, and it's usually relatively straightforward. So familiarity with this is somewhat of a general value. Does anyone have any questions about the very high level before we go into some of the numerics? Nope. Yes? Okay. All right, so what are the equations? Who likes math here? A couple of y'all, maybe three. I'm an engineer. I took far more math than I would have liked, but I'm not a huge fan of it either. That's why we have solvers to do these calculations for us. But it's good to understand what is actually being solved, because sometimes when we approach simulation as just a black box, if we get results we don't expect, we're not really sure if that's because the physical system is what we don't expect, or if there's something weird going on numerically that we need to be aware of. And the better we can understand what's occurring numerically, the better we can help diagnose those problems. The basics of CFD are at least two main conservation equations. Conservation of mass, the continuity equation, and then conservation of momentum. In many cases, we would also include a conservation of energy term as well, though that's not strictly necessary in a lot of cases. But in basically every simulation you run, you'll be solving for conservation of mass and conservation of momentum, and usually conservation of energy as well. So these equations can be broken into nonlinear differential equations, partial differential equations. Fortunately, you don't have to solve those, but they will be represented in a discrete fashion. But essentially what we're doing is we're looking at conservation on a cell level. So assume this little blob here is what we call a control volume. We're making the assumption that everything that's occurring in this control volume is homogeneous. And we need to look at what's coming into it and what's coming out of it to calculate what the values in the center of the control volume are. So from conservation of any quantity X, it may be momentum, it may be energy, it may be mass, we need to make sure that everything coming in and everything going out equal each other, plus any kinds of mass buildup and transient terms that can go in there as well. When we start doing these calculations, there, especially with regards to momentum transfer, there is convection and diffusion that can occur. So in this case, we have two fluids coming in these two pipes. Or maybe it's the same fluid with different temperatures, or maybe there's different values of some tracer. Essentially, they're two similar but not the same fluids. And what we expect to see occurring physically is that once they meet, we start to see a blending of these two regions. How thick and how quickly that blending occurs depends on how different those two fluids are. But that's generally what we should see physically. So what we need to understand is what's going to be occurring in our control volume. And so we'll be seeing convection coming in and out along this main flow. But then we also have a diffusion term that's occurring as well. We have the main convective flow is still this way, but through diffusion you have something coming into your control volume. And our equations need to take this into account to accurately get results. We can also...
Question if I could.
Sure.
Could you just give kind of a Reader's Digest explanation of each of those equations, what those terms are and what they mean?
Yeah. Okay. So in this case, X dot, or X rather, is really any scalar property. In this case, we could look at it, say, that X is temperature. And so mass transport is going to be calculated on the basis of what comes in, what comes out. So because we're looking at, actually, assume X is mass here. We're measuring the mass that comes in, the mass that comes out. There's not really much math that needs to occur with that. It's essentially just a difference here. So it's,
The second equation really is referring to mass flow rate, the middle equation.
This right here?
Oh, no, on the right. I'm looking at the right side.
Right over here. In this case, if I can remember going back to my vector calculus, so X dot is going to be the mass flow rate through our system. And then this dA term represents the face area of our cell. So say we're looking at this face right here. So we're looking at what's coming in and what's coming out across there.
Okay.
The del operator represents that we're doing this in three dimensions. Off the top of my head, I actually don't remember what this term is corresponding to.
That's
the diffusion.
Which one's diffusion?
The first one is convection.
Gamma.
Oh, are we talking about the top equation? Or the, we're still talking about the middle equation, right?
Middle equation.
Okay. So I understand the dA, and I understand the gradient term, or what's the term for that? I've had that before, but
that's the del operator.
Del operator. Okay. And then so those the other terms, what do they mean?
The phi is in this case is going to be the quantity of mass in the system. So we're looking at the gradient of mass through the system. We have a flow rate up and downstream, and that should give us an idea of what's occurring in the middle. That's kind of what we're calculating here. To be completely frank, I need to double check what this term, the second term is. I apologize. I would need to look that one up. Is that the diffusion coefficient?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's convective transport, the first line. How things are crossing this box because it moves. In the second one, how they enter or leave that box because of the diffusion. It's just how each of the different physical processes contributes to accumulation of any quantity inside that box. I don't know if I help you with the complicated one.
That's a pretty good summary of what we're looking at here.
That's what he's saying. There are basically two different mechanisms there. Convection, like moving, like when we blow a gas, just moving because of that first equation. It's basically rho density times some quantity.
When you refer to the first equation, are you talking about the top equation?
Right, yeah.
So the top equation covers convection?
Convection.
And the second one is that diffusion?
That's diffusion.
Yeah, this would be diffusion, and this would be your diffusion coefficient in this case.
But then what is the bottom?
The bottom one is a numerical term that doesn't as closely correspond to reality. This is what we call a source term. Sometimes we can simplify models if there's some kind of a low-level phenomenon that is adding or subtracting from our system. We can use a source term to kind of plug that in there. So if, for instance, chemical reactions would be a great example. Phase changes could be a good example. Sometimes we don't necessarily need to model both sides of those processes, but we need to understand how much of that is, say, coming from the solid into the gas. And then we see that represented by a source term to make our mass balance equations balance out.
Sublimation or melting would be probably described by that term because it's some energy that is being released inside that box. But
the bottom equation.
Yeah, it's a sorption.
Yep. Okay. People have different opinions about whether convection amounts to anything in freeze drying with respect to heat transfer.
Mm-hmm.
Can you answer that question computationally, or do you really need to answer it experimentally?
That's non-dependent to heat transfer.
Yeah, this is convective flow.
That's something driving in the flow. There's some velocity that's moving.
So this has nothing to do with heat transfer?
No, that'll come in the source time. So that is moving based on velocity that's moving.
It somewhat relates to heat transfer, right? They're not completely unrelated. But if we were to look at how heat is propagating throughout our air volume, then we would be solving both of these equations, convection and diffusion, in every calculation. Whether it's significant in your case or not, the solver is going to be calculating it because those are basic transport phenomena that are always occurring. They're not always significant, but they're always occurring. If we're looking at heat that's coming from or going into a solid, and we don't want to explicitly model the temperature through the solid as well, that's where a source term could be taken into account, or that could also be applied at a boundary condition to say that I have heat coming from this boundary. But in both cases, every time we're doing CFD, we are solving diffusion and convection for every cell in our system. Does that make sense?
Okay. Well, I guess, yeah.
So, I mean, to your question of whether or not the simulation can help you understand if it's significant, there are ways of looking at how much heat is being transferred due to convection and how much of it is being transferred due to diffusion. And we can look at those separately because they're calculated separately, but they're both calculated at the same time.
The answer is, as long as we have experimental data, we can verify which mode is important or not.
Yeah. So when we're looking at conservation equations, and we have conservation equations for most every physics that you include in your system, so it's not just mass and momentum and energy, but any additional physics you include as well, those equations are calculated across our mesh. Example we saw on this slide, this control volume where we're doing these calculations, corresponds to a three-dimensional shape that looks like one of these hexes here. Hexagons here. Heptagons. They have different number of faces depending on which one they are. But essentially, each one of these cells, as we call them, represents one of those control volumes. And we are solving the conservation equations across each one of these control volumes. And so what comes into the cell goes out of the cell, plus or minus any source term that may be occurring. And because all these cells are connected to each other, what's coming into the cell we know is coming out of another cell that's adjacent to it. And so by being able to take all these control volumes and solve them simultaneously, on a macroscopic basis, we may only understand what's occurring here, coming in here and coming out over here. But because we're solving the conservation equations in each one of these cells, we can see how information coming in here propagates through each cell through the domain until it comes to the outlet. And that allows us to understand what's occurring in 3D space. Any questions about the numerics? I really skipped over that on a very high level basis. That could be the subject of a number of dissertations if we want to dive into the weeds of it, but does anyone have any questions about numerics before we move on? Okay, boundary conditions. What are boundary conditions? So we have our control volumes, in this case our cells, and we need to understand our conservation equations are telling us what's occurring inside here, but what about on the exterior of our domain? That's kind of where the boundary conditions come in. So there are a number of different boundary types. One of them is for internal flow boundaries. So these are boundaries where we expect to have mass and momentum transferred through them. And so they can be inlet boundary types like velocity inlets where we specify a constant velocity, mass flow inlets where we specify a mass flow. or stagnation inlets, which are pressure-based, where we're defining an upstream stagnation pressure. It can also be things like outlet pressures. So, for instance, we have pressure outlets where we can say, this is what my static pressure is downstream. And in both of these cases, we're taking our calculation domain and connecting it to the rest of the world that we're not simulating. Other types of boundary conditions that we may be interacting with. So, actually, I don't really like the way the slide is formatted, but essentially, whether we're doing internal flow or external flow, we're still going to be defining inlets and outlets. So in this case, if we're modeling these race cars on this racetrack, there is going to be some kind of velocity or pressure or mass flow that's specified upstream. And as it comes along, it's going to hit flow obstructions. Remember that little beam that we saw in the previous example. This flow obstruction is usually going to be prescribed to what we call a wall boundary. And on walls, we assume that it applies friction to fluids in a certain way. The default behavior in what we see in most cases is what we call a no-slip wall, meaning that at the very surface of that wall, on a microscopic basis, there is a zero velocity, and the velocity goes up from there. There's also going to be things related to the surface roughness. In most cases, we can assume a smooth wall, but for especially rough surfaces, we can apply a special roughness, which is going to impact how that velocity gradient develops away from the wall. We can specify things on these internal boundaries, these flow obstructions, based on temperatures. Is this wall adiabatic? Is there going to be a known heat flux or a known temperature on this wall? Things of that nature. And then, again, we would have outlets downstream to reconnect it to the physical world. So there are a number of conditions that get set when you choose a boundary type. There's a number of assumptions that go into that. Just to give some examples, to look at what a wall boundary type would do. So I mentioned that there is a slip wall and a non-slip wall. So on the slip wall, if we're looking at the velocity profile, we're zero right here, and then we have the free stream velocity up here. That's what a non-slip wall is assuming. On a slip wall, we're assuming that there is no resistance to flow, and so there's no profile that develops. It's the same velocity up here and down here. It's possible also to input a partial slip wall where you get something in between the two of these. Surface specification, we're looking at how rough the surface is. In most cases, a smooth wall is a good assumption because the magnitude of the roughness is not significant compared to the boundary layer and the flow structures. But in some cases, that's not a good assumption, and we can specify a wall roughness where we essentially quantify how thick those rough protrusions are. Velocity specifications. Walls can be moving in the physical world and in a simulation world. So a great example is if you have some kind of rotor shader device, say you're actually modeling the inside of a condenser. You've got one wall that's moving with your rotor, and you have another wall that's stationary with the stator part of that. And from a simulation perspective, we need to tell that wall is moving, because when it calculates these profiles, it is calculating it with respect to how fast that wall is moving. So if this wall starts moving this direction, we get a different profile than if it's stationary, because we're calculating relative to the wall wall at zero speed. Some temperature examples. By default, we would define a wall to be adiabatic. We assume that it's perfectly insulated, but that's not always the case. So one thing we could do is we could specify a heat flux. We know that this many joules per meter squared second are leaving our system. We could define a temperature. We know that this wall is at, say minus 20 Celsius, whatever. And the simulation assumes that that's constant. And we could also specify a heat transfer coefficient, which is going to kind of behave somewhere in between the two. Now, what happens, though, if you have a system where you can't assume any one of these. What happens if you know that your temperature is not going to be constant because of the amount of heat that's coming out of it, but you also can't define a constant heat flux or a constant heat transfer coefficient? In those cases, we can do what we call a conjugate heat transfer problem, where we're modeling the heat transfer through the fluid and the heat transfer through the solid in the same simulation. And so, rather than having a thermal specification on the wall, instead, we solve conservation equations across the solid-fluid boundary to measure directly how much heat is transferring. So looking at some results for how things change based on the boundary conditions that we would set. So in this example, we have flow coming in this duct here, and then it goes through this box, and then there are ducts out here. If we were to assume that our walls are not moving, which generally they wouldn't be, we would end up getting a flow profile like this, where most of it is going to be going through this main duct that's straight ahead, but we have a little bit of recirculation. Some of that gets redirected this way, and some of it ends up coming around this way. However, if we were to change our simulation parameters and say that this wall is moving this way, hypothetically speaking, we could say that this wall is a conveyor belt, for instance. I don't know why you have a system like this, but just for the sake of looking at the results of our data, when we still have a lot of flow coming this way, but we have a much stronger flow coming this way, and that's pulling more of this up. We end up getting more flow going through the top pipe than when we did, and we have a lot more flow going this way and recirculating. The only difference between these two is changing the wall boundary condition. So when you're setting up a simulation, it's important to understand what your boundary conditions are actually saying, because that can have a big impact of what's occurring on the inside of your domain. Inlet boundary conditions. One thing we need to specify would be what's the flow direction. Normally, you would want to assume that the flow is in the normal direction. It's coming directly in from our inlet. But we can also define it based on an angle. So we can kind of specify, know it's coming in at this angle. And in that case, you want to understand what your flow rate actually looks like, or what your flow distribution at your inlet actually looks like, because that can have impacts on your downstream data. If you have something that's very chaotic, it may be a good idea to include more of your simulation domain so that you have a more uniform flow and can deal with these sorts of assumptions that go into that. We also have assumptions based on turbulence that get applied at boundary conditions as well. In these LIO applications with the pressures involved, I don't know how much turbulence is occurring in these systems, but if you are including a turbulence model, we also need to kind of tell the system, what's my turbulence look like as it coming in? Is this completely laminar flow that is going to be tripped downstream, or is there some amount of turbulent energy associated with it from the very beginning? And then different boundary types have different physical values that you're specifying. With a velocity inlet, we are specifying a velocity directly, mass flow rates, mass flow inlet, and then stagnation inlets, we're specifying a pressure. Each one of these, we can specify a temperature as well. So no matter which type of flow boundary on your inlet you have, you can define temperature values as well. So looking at the results, if we were to change our inlet condition, again, these are the same simulations with the difference of our boundary. Here we have flow coming in this block that comes over this way. If we set our flow to be normal to our boundary, it comes straight through and then kind of converges towards the outlet. That makes intuitive sense. However, that's making assumption about what the flow looks like over here. Maybe your duct is not feeding directly in here and it's looping around, and you know by the time you get here, your flow direction is not boundary normal. If you specify a different boundary angle, you can see that we get very different results. So again, the assumptions that you're putting into your boundary conditions control what sort of results you get on the outlet, or not on the outlet, on the simulation domain. And here's just another look at a similar example. In this case, in both cases, we're looking at inlet flow normal to the boundary, but we've changed the shape of the boundary. And again, that's going to change our flow patterns in our system because we're making different assumptions at the boundary. Outlet boundary types can be based on static pressure, which is our pressure outlet type, or what we have called a flow split outlet, where we're essentially, if you have multiple outlets, you can say, I want 30% of my flow going through here. And in that case, it would calculate what pressure is required to make that happen. So if you don't know your pressure, but you do know your flow splits, you could use an outlet type like that. These different outlet types, though, have different assumptions on the backflow. So in an ideal world, everything's going on an outlet and there's no recirculation that's occurring there, and it won't really make a difference. But in the actual world, oftentimes there is recirculation that can occur near an outlet boundary. And so there, whether or not the simulation allows that or not is going to change a role in the results that you get. So it's important to understand your boundary types when you're applying them to your system. So here we're looking at the same system changing different boundary types. On the left-hand side, we have flow coming in our duct, and we've specified equal static pressures at these two outlets, 1 and 2. And you can see that we get the results like we saw earlier. However, if we change it from defining the pressure at 1 and 2 to defining a flow split outlet, we can say that outlet 1 gets 80% of the flow. The solver will calculate what needs to happen to make that flow condition satisfied, and what we get is a lot less flow coming out through 2, and we also get a much more chaotic flow in the system because we have such a substantial calculated pressure differential between these two that the flow is not going to allow it to come straight across nearly as well anymore. So again, the boundary conditions that you apply change the results that you get. Now, when it comes to where you place a boundary, this is an important concept. So assume we have, like in our example earlier, we have flow coming in here, and then we have a flow obstruction, and then that obstruction creates a wake. Now, where you specify your boundary in relation to this is going to play a role in how accurately this can be calculated. If you put an outlet boundary right in the middle of this recirculation loop, say we cut off this domain right here, we've only captured half of this recirculation loop. We can calculate what's going on here, but we don't really know what's going on here. And because our boundary is ill-posed, we're not able to get a good resolution of what's occurring here. If we were to move the outlet downstream a ways, we could get data that's going to be much more accurate. Further away, we might get to the point where we're getting qualitatively the same results, but maybe not necessarily quantitatively the same results. But if we move it further away such that the flow condition here is the same as if there had not been that obstruction there, then we can accurately resolve everything that's occurring over here on a numerically accurate basis, and we can have confidence that our outlet is properly posed. So think about that in terms of your systems when you want to kind of constrain the domain you do a simulation on. You want to make sure that your inlets and your outlets are not close enough to flow or geometry features that are going to change the results of what you see on that boundary. So in our LIO example, if we are to say we have a valve below our chamber downstream and we put an outlet boundary directly below that valve, the impact of that valve on the flow will not be fully developed in that case, and so you won't get as accurate resolution of that as if you were to put it further downstream where you don't have that valve impacting the flow directly anymore. Another boundary type that can be useful in simulation is what we call a symmetry boundary. Symmetry boundaries can be applied if we can assume that both the geometry and the velocity fields, or really any scalar fields, are symmetric across the plane. So if you have a design where you can perfectly cut it in half and everything on the left-hand side and on the right-hand side are going to be the same, then using a symmetry boundary has just cut your number of cells in half, and you're able to get results just about twice as fast in that case because you don't need to simulate the same thing twice. However, if it's... Sorry, I'm using a mouse as a clicker, and it's not the best. If, for example, though, you don't have perfect symmetry and you apply a symmetry plane, you may understand what's occurring on one side or the other, but you're not simultaneously doing both. So symmetry boundaries can be helpful in that they reduce your computational time, they reduce the amount of hard drive space you need to store your data, and you can actually do post-processing on it, looking at the entire model in 360 degrees. However, if they're not applicable, then your results will not be accurate. Any questions on boundary conditions? Does that concept make sense to y'all? Okay, I'm seeing some nods. Okay, flow physics. We mentioned that we need to specify our geometry, we need to discretize our domain, and we need to specify boundary conditions. Next, we need to tell what equations are we solving inside our fluid, and that's what the flow physics section is about. So some examples here, if we look back at our control volume, is this going to be air? Is it going to be water? Are there dust particles involved? Or maybe some kind of mist of droplets from water or some other liquid?
So you're talking about mass flow here.
That's part of it, yes. There are other physics that can go into that. Say this is a porous region, and so maybe that's going to impact the way momentum propagates through the region because you're actually inside of a filter. Or maybe there are moving boundaries, there's moving objects in your domain. Those are physics that can be included as well.
Including heat flow?
Yes, that would be another type of physics that would be specified here. So the first basic questions that we need to answer, is this a two-dimensional model or a three-dimensional model? For a two-dimensional model, we assume that one direction can be ignored. Either maybe we're doing something that's perfectly radially symmetrical and we're just looking at a cross-section of it, or maybe we can assume that it extends infinitely in and out of the page. Those are good examples for a two-dimensional system. Two-dimensional simulations are also valuable to help you understand how physics work, but real geometry is usually in three dimensions, and we usually need to do 3D simulations on them. So in that case, we'll be looking at the variation of our solver quantities, whether it be our temperature, our pressure, our momentum, in X, Y, and Z directions. The next question, assuming we're doing a fluid flow simulation, is my fluid compressible or incompressible? If we're assuming liquid flows, we can usually assume incompressible. If we're assuming gas flows, some cases we can still do incompressible. Some cases we have to assume compressibility. If we're going to be getting significant pressure variations, in terms of a percentage of the absolute pressure, for instance, then we would need to have, a compressible system where we can understand how the density is changing with the pressure field. I doubt any of you all are dealing with this, but if you have fluids moving at high Mach numbers, then we would need to assume compressibility because, again, there's going to be significant fluctuations in density. With temperature fluctuations, we can still assume an incompressible fluid but allow it to expand or contract based on temperature. So that's a way of getting something that's not going to be as fully compressible as a true compressible fluid, but still have some of the density deviation that you would expect to see. So it's kind of going to be functionally in the middle between the two. Next question, is this going to be a steady state or a transient simulation? So looking at some examples here, this cyclone separator, a lot of times we can assume these are steady state. What's coming in, what's going out are steady, and so what's occurring on the inside is also going to be steady as well. However, if we are concerned about maybe a vortex that's occurring here and wobbling back and forth, that becomes a transient phenomenon, and then that's where we would need to switch that to a transient simulation. Let me see if I can get this video playing here. An example of something that has to be transient from the start is understanding how the ship is going to be interacting with the waves. So in this case, it's important to look at the timescales that are occurring in our system. Here, the motion of the ship relative to the waves are pretty close timescales, And so it's just a matter of seconds between ship going up, ship going down, ship going up and down. So that's a transient phenomenon that becomes very easy to capture. If we're talking about very long transient phenomena, things on the order of a week, for instance, sometimes it's valuable to simplify our simulation to a steady state simulation because the timescales that are changing from day one to day seven are large enough that to run the entire thing in one simulation transient becomes impractical. But if we focus in on the beginning conditions, the end conditions, we can understand pretty closely what's occurring then from a steady state basis. Next question, is this a fluid region? Is it a solid region? Is it a porous region? Or are there multiple regions I need to include? So some examples that we see here. So say we have a fluid A, fluid B, and then there's some kind of membrane in between the two. You could model this as a membrane that is porous, and you could have flow that comes through here. There's additional resistance to flow that's occurring as it goes through the membrane, and then flow up here that doesn't have that resistance anymore because these are fluid regions and this is a porous region. Alternatively, you could have a solid region here, and say this is a heat exchanger. You've got a hot fluid on one side, a cold fluid on the other, and then from there we've got heat transfer that's occurring here, but we don't have momentum transfer because we don't have momentum transfer through solid regions. We can also look at subdomains within a particular domain. So maybe we have this larger domain here, but we're interested specifically in what's occurring in areas here and here. We can create those as separate regions. They have the same rules as what's going on in this larger region, but we partition them in this way so that we can get more focused data analysis, for instance, at the end of our simulation. So an example of a multi-domain calculation. So here we have this kind of black box heater, and there is an air in here, there is kind of a brick wall, and then there's water up here. What we're able to see from a simulation like this is that we're getting strong natural convection currents that are occurring coming off of this hot block. When it reaches the block, the flow is redirecting around it. We don't have momentum transfer through there. However, we are getting energy transfer through here, and it's kind of hard to see on the slide, but you can see that there are some hot spots that are occurring in the liquid directly above where that fire is. So in this multi-domain simulation where we are simulating three very different phenomena, we've got gas flow, we've got solid heat transfer, and we've got liquid flow, but we can include it all together in one simulation. Another example, conjugate heat transfer, that's what we just saw here, but it's we see this in a lot of different industries. The slide here, this is one of our most common applications that we see tons and tons of usage for. Automotive manufacturers, they run their engines, they need to know how hot their engines are going to get, and they also need to understand where they have hot spots, how long it takes to cool, things like that. So they do a conjugate heat transfer problem because they need to understand the temperature distribution inside the solid as well as the temperature distribution inside the fluid. So that's what they can do. They can simulate the fluid and the solid at the same time. In your case, say you're interested in the temperature distribution in your airspace, but you also are wondering what the temperature distribution in your shelves are. So that could be a conjugate heat transfer problem where you are able to look at a temperature gradient from the top of the shelf to the bottom of the shelf and understand how heat is traveling through that shelf, but you're also seeing how heat is traveling through the airspace as well. Another physics question can be moving regions. So rotational regions, we see this a lot in turbo machinery applications and this pump. We see them a lot in mixing tanks, where we have one piece that's moving, one piece that's stationary, and we can use separate regions to make this more computationally stable and efficient, and so that we can better understand what's occurring from the flow perspective around the moving wall as well as around the stationary wall. We can see that flow through the entire tank that way. Single phase or multi-phase? We have a number of different approaches to doing multi-phase, but single phase you just have a uniform gas, you just have a uniform liquid. Those are pretty straightforward, but a multi-phase equation or a simulation can include a lot of different kinds of physics. You may have particles in your simulation where you want to understand the particle friction and how that's going to impact how the particles are flowing. You may have water droplets, you may have air bubbles, you may have dust, you may have a free surface that you're trying to resolve. Different multi-phase simulations have different approaches associated with them, but there are ways of capturing those types of physics. So in this case, we are pouring one liquid into another. We're seeing how the yellow liquid is interacting with the blue liquid, as well as bubbles that are coming up to the top, and then the new interface that's forming between air, liquid A and liquid B. So that would be an example of a multi-phase equation where you have different fluids. In this case, I think this is kind of an oil-water type mixture, and you need to understand how those bubbles are distributing, how those interfaces are going to distribute. Yeah.
Can you go back to the slide? So that simulation is there from the Eulerian perspective or the Lagrangian?
This would be an Eulerian simulation. What he's asking about, so Eulerian simulations assume that you have multiple continua of fluids. So we kind of define that there is some fraction of liquid yellow liquid everywhere in the domain, and we have a volume fraction of zero up here in this airspace. And we have a volume fraction of zero initially down here, and then we're kind of pouring the stream that has a volume fraction of one. But it's calculating the calculating a velocity, a temperature for each phase at each cell in the domain, and it couples them all together by assuming that every cell just has one pressure value. A Lagrangian simulation is useful when we have discrete particles, discrete elements, discrete droplets. It's useful for where you have low concentrations of a secondary phase, but there, rather than assuming that there's a continuum, we have individual particles that we're tracing as they move around the system and figuring out how they're interacting with the fluid around them. So a lot of times we would do particle simulations using a Lagrangian type methodology called a discrete element model. Sometimes if you want to do spray droplets, you would resolve those droplets with a Lagrangian simulation, because the droplets by and large are a small percentage of the overall volume, but you need to understand how those droplets are propagating. Okay, meshing. We have an entire day's class on meshing that gives better understanding of how to build good meshes and what a good mesh means. But the most important concept to be aware of is that if we don't have a good mesh, we're not going to have a good solution. We may not get a solution at all because the simulation diverges, but this is where that concept of a mesh convergence study is. A good mesh will not impact a solution. A bad mesh will. So you need to have a mesh that's sufficient so that it's not significantly impacting your solution. So, kind of the workflow, if we go back to the idea of having solids and wetted geometry, say we have this pipe here. It's a solid pipe. That's what our manufacturer gave us for CAD, because they're not building wetted fluids. They're building solid parts. So they say, here's your pipe. We need to take the fluid geometry out of it. We're extracting this fluid geometry, and then that's what we're building our computational mesh on. So we're taking the solids, breaking up the fluid, and then breaking up the fluid into the discrete control volumes where we can do our calculations. Meshing is done on a surface basis and then converted into a volume basis downstream during the meshing pipeline. Extraction of a fluid domain. So kind of an example of what that looks like. We have this ball valve or this T-valve here. And from the solid CAD, we can extract the fluid volume, and then we run a simulation in just the fluid, but we can also place it in context of the solid geometry so that you don't look at this and be like, what on earth am I looking at? Oh, I'm looking at a valve, and now I see where my flow through this valve is based on how I've turned that valve angle. Extracting a fluid geometry can be done in a number of ways. If you're building something from scratch, you may just be able to build the wetted geometry to start with. If you are getting CAD from another source, though, you may use external CAD software. If your companies have CAD, we do StarCCM Plus interacts very well with pretty much all the major CAD packages. And if you have CAD and another tool, we can bring it in pretty directly. There's also what we call native CAD, or not native, neutral CAD files that can be taken into any tool. So say you're using SolidWorks, you can create what's called a parasolid file, and then pretty much any kind of simulation software could read in something like a parasolid file. CFD softwares, including StarCCM Plus, oftentimes will have internal CAD tools. So maybe you could bring in the solid CAD into StarCCM Plus and then extract your fluid volume there. Sometimes we can do simpler operations that aren't on a CAD level, like just a basic subtract. Or we also have a tool called a surface wrapper, where essentially if you have something that's large and complex, we could essentially shrink wrap it to figure out what it's shaped like to get our wetted geometry. Or we could fill up a balloon on the inside of it to fill out what the fluid space is and leave the solid parts behind. Some basic terminology. The mesh is, it would be this entire block. So say we had a cube that we've meshed. Our mesh would be the entire block of 5 by 5 by 5, 125 cells. Each unit in here is going to be your cell, and that's where we're doing our calculations. Remember those conservation equations? We're solving conservation here, we're solving conservation here, we're solving conservation here. These are bounded by our boundary conditions, and each cell is bounded by the cell adjacent to it. Each cell is going to have a face. So each one of these cubic cells has six faces. Depending on the mesh type, there are different numbers of faces that you're going to have, but essentially the face is where that cell is interacting with an adjacent cell or where it's interacting with an external boundary. An edge is going to be the line on the side of the face, and then the node is going to be the corner where edges meet. I forgot this was animated, but hopefully I explained that such that what you're seeing on the screen here is not a surprise to those definitions. Meshes can be structured or unstructured. Simplified university-type problems, oftentimes people love doing structured meshes because you are able to get high-quality meshes that align with your flow direction really well, and you're able to pretty directly quantify how much artificial dissipation is going to be injected due to the numerical calculation. However, for real-world geometries, usually building a structured mesh is impractical because complex geometries and structure meshes don't play well together. You end up needing very precise measurements. It requires a lot of manual effort to build, and it's usually not practical. So most commercial CFD tools, including StarCCM Plus, rely heavily on what we call unstructured grids, which is what we see here. So in this case, you would have a surface mesh that defines your geometry on your edges, and then it grows a volume mesh from there in an irregular pattern to make every cell on your surface mesh fit together. If you look from what's occurring here versus what's occurring here, it's not a direct line from here to here. You've got a lot of wavy growth that's occurring, but that unstructured grid can much more efficiently model your simulation domain so that you can get results in a much timelier fashion. There are a few different types of structured meshes, or unstructured meshes rather. The one that has been the gold standard in the CFD industry for a long time is what we call a tetrahedral grid. Tetrahedral grids are able to model complex shapes no matter how complex they are. They can model tight corners, unusual curvature, things of that nature. But they can be somewhat expensive to calculate because you're dealing with complex shapes. So it takes time to actually build the mesh. And that's solver time, that's not necessarily user time. From there, though, the next generation of these types of unstructured meshes are polyhedral meshes. Polyhedral meshes are built from tetrahedral meshes, so there's a little bit of additional computational time associated with building the mesh. However, because of the way the cells are shaped, you're much more likely that no matter what direction your flow is going, it's going to be flowing out of your cell relatively close to the face normal, which means it converges faster and you get less artificial numerical dissipation into your system, so you get more accurate answers faster. We recommend that there's almost no circumstances where you would want to use tetrahedrals. You can build tetrahedral meshes in SAR-CCM+, but we recommend going with polyhedrals for most cases. We also have what are called pseudo-structured grids. These are ones that throughout most of them, they follow a pretty structured manner, but as you get closer to surfaces, they become unstructured. So a trim cell mesh is a great example of that. It builds this Cartesian grid for cells. You get these cubic-like cells, but as you get close to these surfaces, you find that the objects inside this don't line up perfectly with your grid. And so it just trims the edge of the cell off to fit your grid, or to fit your geometry. So in the bulk, it's structured. Near the wall, it's unstructured. That's why we call it pseudo-structured. And the dodecahedral mesh is a kind of that same concept, but with a polyhedral grid, where it's going to be very structured out in the bulk flow, but it gets unstructured close to the surface. All four of these mesh types can be created in SAR-CCM+. These two tend to get the most usage, the polyhedral and the trim cell. Wall prism layers. When you're doing meshing, it's important to accurately resolve all of your flow structures. And one of the most common ones that needs to be resolved is, what is that wall boundary layer? If you want to understand heat transfer from a solid to a fluid, for instance, you need to understand what the boundary layer looks like, or else you won't get an accurate calculation of what the heat transfer coefficient is. And so you won't know how much heat is entering or leaving your fluid from the solid. Prism layers are a computationally efficient manner of resolving boundary layers. So whether you want to know your heat transfer coefficient, or you want to know something flow related like a flow separation along an airfoil, the prism layers are important to understand what's occurring in that near wall flow area, which then gives you more confidence with the more macroscopic results. So prism layers are going to be shaped in two dimensions like the rest of your cells, but in one dimension they're just a prism. So in this case, we have these polyhedral kind of soccer ball shaped cells. Imagine a slice of those. That's what all of these cells along the wall are. When you look at them in this cross section, they look just like rectangles. If you looked at them from the top, they would look a lot like this, but they're simplified in that one direction to be more prismatic. And we can add in prism layers for any type of mesh. So if you're building polyhedral or trim cell or tetrahedral, you can add prism layers into your model. Any questions about meshing? No? Okay. We're gonna have not this moment, but soon we're coming up on a break. I see that we've got some sleepy eyes in the room. So if you're having a hard time staying awake or need a break, it's coming soon. Don't worry. Data analysis. Data analysis is where we're actually asking questions from our simulation. So, when we do a simulation, we have a lot of data. Remember, each cell in our domain, we have quantities for. We know what the pressure is. We know what the velocity in X, Y, and Z directions are. We know what the temperature is. We may know what a phase concentration is. We may know, other parameters based on what physics you add. However, if we were to take what the solver is seeing and dump that out, you would have a very long data table. It's cell coordinates, these are the values. Cell coordinates, these are the values. And that's not usable for humans. You don't really get a lot of value from that, because you can't scan a data table that has a million rows and maybe 50 or 100 columns and draw insights from that. That's just not how the human brain works. So what data analysis, or sometimes called post-processing, aims to do is figure out how best to package your data so that you can draw the insights you need to draw. So data analysis can be prepared before or after a CFD simulation. So you don't have to worry of, oh, I ran the simulation, but I forgot that I wanted to look at the streamline. What do I do? I don't want to rerun my simulation. Well, the data is already there. We can just calculate a streamline on top of it. That's pretty straightforward. We recommend preparing data analysis before doing your simulation, for a couple of reasons. One, you can actually visualize how the solution is developing. This can be a quick sanity check, because if you initialize your equation or initialize your simulation and you thought that everything was occurring on a vacuum condition, and you find that rather than everything being 10 pascals, we're looking at 10 megapascals, for instance, well, that's wrong, and you don't want to find out hours later when the simulation is complete, you would know it immediately. Also, this can be a good way of making sure that your simulation is converging in the direction you think it's going to. If it's going off this way and you know it should be going off this way, stop it before it completes, make a change, fix it. And sometimes it's useful to be able to see how data is progressing, even if it's going in the right way, because that can help you get kind of some preliminary conclusions of what you would need to know from this before you have the final solution. Data analysis can be done on a visual representation, or we can also do graphs and charts. Depending on what you're measuring, one is more appropriate than another. But in StarCCM Plus, we can do 3D flow visualizations, we can do animations, we can do graphs, we can also do user-defined calculations. So say you have some kind of metric that you're calculating for your system, and it's you're the only person in the world who does it because your company has developed it over the last 10 years. It's important to you. You can write that in a pretty easy manner and then have StarCCM Plus calculate that for you. So you'll be able to see how that is changing with time, or you may be able to see what the spatial distribution of this parameter is, things like that. So data analysis can be grouped in a couple of different ways. We have the visualizations, and that's going to be do things like contour plots that we've seen examples of, or streamlines that we've seen examples of. Isosurfaces are commonly used for example free surface calculations, things like that. We can also have reporting sections, and these come in a few different categories. We can look at system things like how much computational time have I spent? How long has it taken the simulation to run? It can be statistical things like what's my maximum or minimum pressure in my system? What's the uniformity of the temperature? What's the standard deviation of the velocity? Things like that. Or you can create expressions, and those can come in a lot of different forms depending on what you're writing. So an example of visualization. All four of what you see here, these are the same simulation data. What we're looking at is different ways of packaging the data so that we can then draw analysis. So a couple of different changes that we're making is from left to right, the two on the left, and actually this one. This one's the only one that's not, this one's not two. Top and bottom. The top is what we call a filled value. So here it's taking the value in each cell, and you can start to see that sometimes the results are a little bit jagged. That corresponds to what your mesh looks like. We have a value in this cell center, we have a value in this cell center, and so you see those represented as different colors. However, you know that physically your gradient should look more like this. It's going to be a lot more rounded. So what we can do is we can actually smooth this from a post-processing perspective. So rather than looking at this, we can look at something like this and understand more directly, oh, this is actually what it's shaped like, and I can draw conclusions from that. We also have different types of color bars. We have a couple of examples. We've got actually three different color bars that are being shown here. But different color bars can be useful depending on what you're looking at. Some color bars, sometimes the default red-blue color bar that you'll see in pretty much any 3D simulation software, sometimes that's useful and just go with it. Sometimes you need something that shows higher contrast. So, for instance, comparing this and that, there's a flow structure over here that if you look closely, you can see that there's a little bit of green here, but it's hard to see. But if I put it on a different color bar, it's a lot more obvious as what's occurring here, and then you can look down and see how that, see what numbers that corresponds to. Some color bars are designed to help you pick out small differences in data very easily. Other color bars are designed to help you pick out large differences in data very easily. And neither one is better than another, but oftentimes one color bar will be better than another in a particular circumstance. This is an example of an isosurface. Here we're looking at constant turbulent viscosity. But essentially an isosurface is the scalar surface that can be developed where every point on the surface has the same scalar value. So a classic example would be when you're doing a free surface calculation, you want to know where the interface between the water and the air is. You can create an isosurface of that where the volume fraction of water is 0.5, because everything below that is going to be air, everything above that is going to be water, and that's what your isosurface is showing. But you can also do isosurface for any other parameter. You can look at what's my surface of constant temperature? What's my surface of constant pressure? Things like that. Vector plots, can look at, we do glyphs like this where in each cell you have little arrows that are pointing in the direction of the flow, and how long they are corresponds to what the velocity magnitude is. And then you can color them by some other value. In this case, they're colored by velocity magnitude. So as they get redder and longer, that indicates faster velocity. But they can also be colored by something different. So you could have long arrows represent faster velocities, but they're colored by pressure so that you get different results. Well, not different results, but you get different analysis of the results. We can also overlay multiple objects in the same scene to help you understand how different data fields are interacting with each other, and also help you understand the relationships therein. You can present visuals that are more concise. So rather than looking at this plot for my temperature, this plot for my vector field, this one for something else, and this one for something else, we can package these into a much smaller number of plots and really take advantage of the fact that a picture can be worth 1,000 words. You can put more data into a scene and make it concise, make it clear what's going on, and there's a lot more value in that. And this is actually my last slide before our break. Here's an example of streamlines. Here we're looking at streamlines that are colored by temperature as it's going through the shell and tube heat exchanger. So here you can see the streamlines are following the vector field, so we can see that the fluid is coming this way through the system, through around these baffles, and we can see how much it's penetrating inside the tube bundle, but we can also see how the temperature is changing as it's doing this. So here they're blue, we're looking at temperatures around maybe 26 Celsius, but we can see by the time we get up here, we're looking at temperatures maybe 33, and by the time we get to the outlet over here, you're up into the 40s. So you're understanding the relationship between the flow patterns and the temperature field at the same time.